From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we meet a group chosen to represent Michigan in today's presidential inaugural parade.
Everyone is very excited to be here and just in awe of this incredible opportunity.
We'll meet the military spouses of Michigan, and we look at presidential inaugurations through history.
Second inaugural addresses usually occur after the president has been chastened by experience. I mean, the lofty optimism that often characterizes first inaugural addresses is missing.
Plus, growing up biracial in Michigan, adopted by a white family.
I often get the question, because I'm biracial, is how come you identify as black and not white? My smart answer is, well, I never knew I had a choice.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this Martin Luther King Jr. Day 2013, President Barack Obama has been sworn in for his second term as the 44th President of the United States. On today's show, we look back with a presidential historian about inaugurations from the past. And we'll talk with Jocelyn Benson, President of Military Spouses of Michigan. She's walking with the group in the inaugural parade today in Washington. But first, from the executive branch to the judicial. State Supreme Court Justice Diane Hathaway's resignation from the High Court becomes official today. Her judicial career is in tatters thanks to allegations of bank fraud related to a private real estate deal. Last Friday, she was charged with bank fraud in federal court in Detroit. Larry Dubin is a University of Detroit Mercy law professor. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Recap for us again, Larry. Explain what Diane Hathaway is accused of doing with this real estate deal.
Well, she owned a number of different properties, both in Florida and in Michigan. One of her properties apparently had gone underwater in the sense that the amount of money owing on the mortgage was substantially more than the value of the property. And she therefore wanted to sell that property, and instead of incurring the financial loss by paying the difference between the mortgage and what the property was worth, engaged in a short sale. Mm-hmm. And without making it more complicated than necessary, to get a short sale from the banking institution that owned the mortgage, she had to show that she was without funds to pay for it. And in order to do that, she had transferred her other properties to family members, had the short sale take place, and then received those properties back. So I guess, in essence, what we could say is that she attempted to show her inability to pay for the mortgage in question by disowning the other properties that she owned, and that's the alleged bank fraud.
And I suspect, had she just, you know, let the other family members keep the title, am I right that, oh, well, who cares, right? It's the fact that it was transferred back to her after the sale?
Yes, I think the fact that she, in fact, did this, these transfers, with the intent of receiving them back once the short sale took place, was the impropriety. If she legitimately had transferred these properties with no intention of receiving them back, then her disclosure as to the non-ownership of them would have been an honest representation.
Of course, now that she's resigned, charges have now been filed. So what comes next for Diane Hathaway?
Well, I think the expectation is that there are a number of different matters that have to be resolved. The fact that she's no longer a justice of the Michigan Supreme Court means that now that matter is resolved. There is the criminal complaint that was filed against her, the information, which has to be resolved. And the expectation is that there may be a plea agreement entered between her and the U.S. Attorney's Office, which we will be hearing about in the future. So there will be some resolution of the criminal matter. And then, of course, there's the issue of her license as a lawyer, which hinges on the way in which the criminal matter is resolved. If there is a criminal conviction, then a lawyer automatically loses his or her right to practice.
And there have been quite a few, I noticed, angry letters to the editor in different papers about the fact that she does qualify for a pension for her judicial service, not only on the Supreme Court, but on the Circuit Court prior to that. Could that be jeopardized as well?
Well, I don't think so. I think that whatever wrong she committed that has given rise to her current problems, that wrong clearly occurred when she was a member of the Michigan Supreme Court and is now paying the consequences for that those improprieties. She did serve as a Wayne County Circuit Court judge for a number of years. Her pension would have vested, which means she has a right to that pension that existed prior to her service on the Michigan Supreme Court. So I think at least my sense of calling for her not to receive her pension seems to be to some extent political in nature. At least the individuals who've been identified with that call seem to be of a political persuasion that is not in conformity with hers. So she may be entitled to what she has accomplished in the past. The fact that she is now having these problems does not negate everything else she has ever done in her professional career. And I think it is fair to say that these current issues should not totally define everything that she has accomplished.
We're talking with University of Detroit Mercy Law Professor Larry Dubin, looking at the resignation today of State Supreme Court Justice Diane Hathaway and also the criminal charges that were filed against her in federal court in Detroit, allegations of bank fraud. And of course, Larry, this is all very bad news for Democrats because Diane Hathaway was a Democratic nominee and her term wasn't going to expire until the end of 2016. And of course, good news if you're a Republican, as her downfall and resignation clears the way for Governor Snyder to appoint her replacement, and that'll give the GOP a hefty 5-2 majority on the Supreme Court. So who are some of the names that you're hearing about being talked about as a possible replacement?
Well, the names that I have come across, and these are the names who I believe the governor would be considering, and I think an obvious one would be Colleen O'Brien, a circuit court judge in Oakland County who did run unsuccessfully in the last race for Michigan Supreme Court and came very close. She had 21% of the vote, and the winners, Stephen Markman, a sitting Michigan Supreme Court justice, and Bridget McCormick, who won a position having been a professor at the University of Michigan, they both had 23%. So she did reasonably well. She ran in the race, Republican-backed, by getting the opportunity to run for the seat. So I think she would be a logical person to see the governor pick, and that should please members of his party. The governor might be considering someone on his staff, as other governors have in the past. Michael Godola is someone who works for Governor Snyder. He may be under consideration. And then there's some other judges in Michigan who I think might be considered. Curtis Wilder, who's a Michigan Court of Appeals judge, David Viviano, who's a Macomb County Circuit judge, are names that have been mentioned for consideration. And I think you're absolutely right. From the purely from a political standpoint, this is a political gift to the Republican Party. These seats are hard-fought, very expensive to run a political campaign for, and Diane Hathaway did prevail in a very heated and expensive campaign. So to lose that seat and now simply have the governor be able to make a Republican appointment is very significant in further shifting the balance of power between the Democrats and the Republicans on the Michigan Supreme Court.
So, Larry Dubin, what do you feel we should look for in terms of the direction of future Supreme Court decisions?
Well, in general, if you're going to, you know, generalize, because you can't always use the broad brush, sometimes a given justice surprises us with where we think they will come out and where they actually rule. But for the most part, I think the Republican Supreme Court justices tend to view decision-making more favorable to business than individuals who are involved in litigation, and perhaps are a bit more conservative with respect to their decisions in the criminal justice arena. So, again, making some generalized statements about that, this would simply further the strength of that potential voting block on the Michigan Supreme Court from 4-3 for the conservatives to 5-2.
Larry, I've got to wonder, amongst lawyers, amongst Michigan's legal community, are all of you doing what so many of us non-legal types are doing when we hear this whole story of Diane Hathaway's downfall, which is, you know, palm to forehead? What were they thinking?
Well, there is always, lawyers are in a position of always being challenged in terms of being ethical and being moral. And certainly when you're on the Michigan Supreme Court or any judge, you have to be very conscious of the ethical ramifications of your private life and professional life. And I can remember when I served as an appointee from the Michigan Supreme Court on the Michigan Attorney Grievance Commission, which investigates and prosecutes lawyers, one of the things that we always talked about on that commission was that you have to view ethics as if whatever you're going to do could be in the headlines of the newspapers the next day. I mean, you have to be very conscious not only of what you might do that will never be made public, but assume it would be made public to help guide you in getting to the deep conscience level of your moral decisions and ethical decisions. And, you know, we're all human beings, and in this instance, her bad decision did not have to do with her professional obligations on the court, but had to do with her personal life. And it's very unfortunate that perhaps that test that we used to consciously talk about on the Attorney Grievance Commission didn't make its way into her consciousness.
Larry Dubin is a professor at the University of Detroit Mercy Law School. Larry, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Still to come, on this Inauguration Day, we look back at inaugurations of America's past. And we'll speak with one Michigander who was chosen to march in today's parade from the Capitol to the White House. That story in 15 minutes. You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this Inauguration Day 2013, the second inauguration of Barack Obama, we got to wondering about the highs and the lows of presidential inaugurations through our history. Who better to satisfy our curiosity than Gleaves Whitney? He directs the Hahnstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University, and he's written or edited 15 books exploring our presidents and the governors of Michigan. Welcome, Gleaves.
Hi there, Cindy.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Well, this year brings kind of an unusual inaugural doubleheader. We're actually getting two, one private and one public. Explain this for us.
Well, this often happens when you have a Sunday and then a Monday. And, of course, it's stipulated in the Constitution that it's going to be January 20th. But it often happens, you know, where you have to have two inaugurals. It sometimes happens because of a Sunday event, or sometimes the weather has forced this to occur. So we've had a variety of arrangements for inaugurations over the years.
And so today will be the big public inauguration. And one of the moments that I think the nation has really come to expect is that that presidential strut somewhere along Pennsylvania Avenue when the president and first lady hop out of their armored limo and they walk a spell. And this really is not an old tradition, is it?
No, it's really not. And I tell you, it's interesting that Carter went the whole length because he wanted to make a statement about simplifying. And, of course, his inaugural, the whole thing costs so much less money than these things typically cost. So simplicity can be a virtue. Getting out to the people can be a virtue. I mean, let's face it, President Barack Obama has had rock star appeal. When you look at what happened in the first inauguration back 4 years ago, a very, very attractive candidate, a president who comes in with a lot of hope attached to him. And it's just a nice touch. You know, we're so overprotected. Of course, we're having gun debates right now. And when the presidents decide to get out and the first lady get out and are closer to the people, it's really a hit.
I will note the first ladies have to do the walks in heels.
They sure do. Now, they better be filling all the cracks on Pennsylvania Avenue.
You got that right. You don't want Michelle to break a heel. So who was the first president to be sworn in Washington?
It was Thomas Jefferson in 1801, because prior to that, the capital had been in Philadelphia, and prior to that, New York City, where George Washington was actually sworn in. And that first inauguration of Jefferson's is famous because that's where he said, you know, we are all Republicans, we are all Federalists. It's one of the great bipartisan statements in all inauguration history, and it had been just a bruising campaign. You and I have talked about that before.
Yes.
And, I mean, really, it sank to the depths. Nothing in recent years went as low as our founding fathers went in 1801. So Jefferson very graciously reaches out to the Federalists whom he had defeated and tries to assuage, you know, their pain for having lost and really disappearing as a party.
Well, am I correct that John Adams actually skipped town rather than face Jefferson's inauguration?
Oh, absolutely. John Adams would have nothing to do with it, and they weren't able to kiss and make up for another 13 years.
But they finally did do that.
Yeah.
So looking back, what was the most surprising moment in your opinion? I saw something about a cowboy and a lasso.
Oh, boy, Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, that is certainly one of the most odd moments. When he was in, Eisenhower was in a grandstand, and of course he was born in Texas. A lot of people associate him with Kansas.
Yes.
But this cowboy rides up to him, I guess striking up the Texas connection, and lassoed the president. And this was in January 1953. And that surely would have caused the Secret Service all kinds of fits.
I would suspect. I shudder to think what might happen if someone tried that today.
Well, there were two surprises, really, with the Eisenhower inauguration. One of them is this cowboy incident, which is so funny. But the other is really striking in retrospect. I think that Eisenhower was the first and only president to write his own prayer into the inaugural address.
Okay.
So that was kind of different. We aren't used to presidents being like priests or preachers at their inaugural addresses, but it's his gesture was a first.
Speaking of the speeches, who had the shortest speech?
Oh, that was George Washington's second inaugural address. See, Abraham Lincoln, you go back to him, he details why we even have an inaugural address. Of course, it's not really prescribed in the Constitution. All the Constitution says is the president will address the Congress on an annual basis and take the swearing-in oath. But Washington decides to make a statement, and Lincoln later, some 80 years later, describes the mission statement. He says the president should make a statement that's detailed of the course to be pursued. That's the mission. And Lincoln's ability to do that, of course, is a master of the language, created one of the greatest inaugural addresses ever in the second inaugural address. Washington, by contrast, with his very short inaugural address, said, hey, all of you know what has been going on, so I'm not going to detail what we're going to be doing. And, of course, you didn't have the mass media in that day to broadcast it, so there wasn't the urgency to do so.
In fact, certainly the inaugural speeches have been the president's big moment to shine, and over the years, some of them have made the most of that bully pulpit. Let's take a listen.
So, first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
So, Gleese, tell us how our second inaugural addresses, like the one President Obama gives, they are different from the first, just as you told us with George Washington. Hey, you know what I'm about. Do most presidents have a different tenor in the second address?
I think so. First of all, second inaugural addresses usually occur after the president has been chastened by experience. I mean, the lofty optimism that often characterizes first inaugural addresses is missing. Now, this can be a little bit different. For example, George W. Bush, 8 years ago, kind of went out on a limb when he needed to backtrack a little bit and explain why we were in Iraq. And for that reason, he talked about the Middle East being really a fruitful ground for freedom, a new birth of freedom in the world. So sometimes they can be lofty like that, but typically second inaugural addresses are more sober. I mean, look at Abraham Lincoln's, where he's saying our country has been chastised through the Civil War. Both the North and the South, the people have prayed to the same God, they've read the same Bible, but this country has suffered so much, and he's looking into the inscrutable will of God to try to figure out what has this country been through. Second inaugurals are often very forgettable. They don't typically have the one-liners that we remember first inaugurals for.
Now, talk to us about the longest speech, which also, I think, leads to the category of dumbest things a president's ever done at his inauguration. And hello, William Henry Harrison, we are talking to you.
Oh, I tell you, and it's flu season. This is a great time to remind ourselves of how dumb people can be. It is a macho thing about some of these presidents, and William Henry Harrison decides to go out there. There's a howling snowstorm. He gives an oration between almost 2 hours long.
Whoa.
And without his overcoat, without his top hat, and he ends up in bed for the next 30 days, and then he dies.
Died of pneumonia, didn't he?
I've got to add, Cindy, that particular inaugural address is one that historians love because Harrison actually gave the details of what a Whig presidency should look like, and it's one of the great statements that we have of Whig policies and first principles. So it's too bad he died. I mean, it would have been interesting to watch how he would have tried to enact these things.
That's interesting, but it's a good document for study at the very least.
Well, the same thing happened actually with John F. Kennedy. Let's go back to the 35th president.
Yes.
That sparkling, we had that snowstorm go through the night before, and it left this sparkling city with all the glaring snow, and Kennedy wanted kind of to make a macho gesture. I mean, he was not the old Eisenhower. He was the new young buck, and he was going to give that inaugural address without a coat, and he did.
Curious, as far as the weather, when it comes to extremes, who got the best and worst from old man winter?
Well, it happens to be Ronald Reagan. He got the best and the worst. His first inaugural was delightful. I think the temperature went up to about 55 degrees, and it was kind of a symbol from Reagan's point of view that the country had turned the corner. It was no longer the winter of the Carter years where, there had been talk of malaise and all that business.
And literally, am I correct that the Iranian hostages were released during the inauguration?
Yes, wouldn't you know it?
Yeah.
I mean, the sunshine came out on the American spirit because those Iranian hostages were released as sort of the ultimate up-years to Carter.
Boy, wasn't it though.
Oh, gosh, terrible. And then 4 years later, Ronald Reagan, just to balance things out, had the coldest weather to contend with. In fact, they had the formal ceremony actually was in the rotunda, and he was sworn in inside because it was so cold.
Cleves Whitney, talk to us about parties. Which presidents had the rowdiest celebrations? Because isn't it true that once we, the common people, could have gone right into the White House and put our mud-stained boots on that White House carpet?
Well, I tell you, Andrew Jackson, the father of more of our populist democracy, had a real great party that it was so bad that people were jumping in and out of the windows. And in fact, one brain got the idea, get all of the liquor, all the beer out on the lawn so that people would go out the windows and out of the White House to party out there. But the other rowdy one, of course, was Lincoln. I mean, that was a pretty good party that the soldiers had to actually come in and help police.
There you go. That is a party. So we're ever so much more sedate today.
We are. But you want to be on the A-list of these things. I mean, look at all the balls. I mean, you've got just these great extravaganzas. People go, this is one of the most unifying social events. It's almost up there with the Super Bowl. It's unifying people from all backgrounds, all over the country, come together. They want to be on those A-lists. They've written to their congressman to get a seat at the inauguration itself, and then they want to be part of the parties. And it's just one of those fun times when we can just let our hair down and enjoy unity as a country.
And we could all use a little more of that.
We sure could.
Gleaves, thank you so much for joining us today.
Cindy, it's a pleasure.
Gleaves Whitney directs the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University, and he has written a number of books looking at our presidents or the governors of Michigan, and we have anointed him stateside's presidential historian.
Thank you.
In his speech today, President Obama called on lawmakers to find common ground, even as he previewed his goals for a second term, including immigration reform and stricter gun control laws. And he made history today during his speech when he mentioned both the Stonewall Uprising and then called for gay and lesbian people to be treated, quote, like anyone else under the law. It's the first time a president has addressed gay rights during an inauguration speech. A major part of today's inaugural festivities is the parade from the Capitol to the White House running along Pennsylvania Avenue. It's the most attended event of the inauguration because you don't need tickets, and it's watched by millions more on television. Over 2,800 groups applied to march in the parade, and one of those chosen was the Military Spouses of Michigan. The president of Military Spouses of Michigan is Jocelyn Benson, interim dean of the Wayne State University Law School. Her husband is currently deployed in Afghanistan. Jocelyn joined us earlier today from Washington. For a group that started only about a year ago, this is quite a way to step into the spotlight.
Oh, it's incredible also because so many of us, and we're here with 90 spouses, kids, and family members from all around Michigan. And it's so exciting because, you know, we honor our veterans, we honor our service members, but too often our military families are on the sidelines supporting those who serve when their sacrifice is often overlooked. So to be able to recognize their sacrifice today and be a part of that here in this parade is really gratifying and incredible.
What's everybody's mood like? I'm kind of wondering, is there a sense of being solemn in the history of the moment or excited or all of the above?
Well, interestingly, everyone is very excited to be here and just in awe of this incredible opportunity. We have a lot of children under the age of 10 marching with us, too, and we were a little bit concerned that the hours standing to go through security might be hard on them, but every single one of them has been bright-eyed and enjoying the entire process. So everyone's in good spirits, everyone's excited to march, and everyone is honored to have been selected by the Presidential Inauguration Committee to honor the president in this way today.
Why do you feel it was so important here in Michigan to have a group like yours? You've only been around about a year, but a very important mission that you've put together for the Military Spouses of Michigan.
Yes, well, because Michigan does not have an active duty base, our Army base in particular, oftentimes our spouses and families are scattered around the state. And because of that, many of us go through deployments feeling very isolated and oftentimes alone because we're not around people who are dealing with similar struggles or experiences. And so experiencing that myself, I came together with three other spouses who were also about to encounter a deployment. We decided to start this organization to support each other. And it's just grown over the past year. We now have over 200 spouses as members, and many of them are here with me today marching in this parade. And it's been an incredible experience for each of us because instead of feeling isolated and alone and struggling through a deployment on our own, we're able to provide that camaraderie for each other. And it's empowered all of us to be stronger support systems for our service members who are serving abroad as well.
Jocelyn Benson, what do you feel that the presence of Military Spouses of Michigan in the inaugural parade, what does that say to the rest of the nation about the contributions made by the spouses and the partners and the kids of our military men and women?
It's a beautiful recognition of a community that oftentimes supports and serves on the sidelines and who sacrifice every day, but oftentimes their stories go untold. And to be a part of an experience now where we're able to share this with other spouses, and many of whom are having a difficult time in a deployment or a difficult time economically, to be able to provide this trip to Washington, D.C. for them to see the president and march in the parade has been a huge boost to their enthusiasm and morale. And so it's helped us, I think, help others get through a difficult time and also give them the recognition they deserve for their service.
Jocelyn, your husband is currently deployed in Afghanistan, as we mentioned. What did he say when he found out that you and the members of Military Spouses of Michigan would be marching with the president?
we were all, he included, we were just in awe of being selected, not just to represent our state of Michigan, but also to represent military spouses and families. We're the only military family organization in the entire parade. And so he was thrilled. I think that the most difficult thing for both of us is that he can't be here to experience this as well, since he's right now in Afghanistan. But we're taking lots of pictures and trying to record the experience so that he'll be here in spirit, if not in person.
As you prepare to really become a part of history and be part of the parade, I'm kind of curious. I know 4 years ago it was brutally cold for the inauguration. How is it today for all of you?
Well, you know, yesterday in Washington, D.C., it was almost 60 degrees. So it's a little bit cooler today, but we prepared for the cold. And as we march, all 90 of us will be wearing red scarves that symbolize the love that we have for our service members. We'll be wearing buttons that represent our organization. And each of us will be carrying a flag that represents the branch of the military that our service member is in. So we are prepared for the cold, and it's actually perfect weather for what we prepared for. And we are just excited to start marching and see families from all over the country and represent and honor our service members and their families.
Jocelyn Benson is the president of Military Spouses of Michigan, marching in today's inaugural parade along Pennsylvania Avenue. We should also mention that Michigan is also represented by the multi-jurisdictional Mounted Police Drill Team and Color Guard of Ypsilanti. So the two Michigan units in the parade today. Jocelyn, thank you for talking with us.
And thank you so much for having me.
Have fun. What more can we say? Up next, we talk with Michigan-born author Kevin Hoffman about his memoir, Growing Up Black in White. This is Stateside. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One very inescapable aspect of President Barack Obama's story is that he's grown up with one foot in the world of black people and one foot in the world of white people. His mother, of course, was white from Kansas. His black father was from Kenya. Just what is it like with a stake in both of these worlds, and how does it inform a person's view of the world? Well, Kevin Hoffman knows what it is to live in both the worlds of black and white. He was born to a white mother and a black father. Born in Detroit in 1967, just 2.5 weeks after the Detroit riots. He was placed in foster care before being adopted by a white family, where he became the fourth of their children. His memoir is entitled Growing Up Black in White. Kevin Hoffman joins us now from Toledo. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So, Kevin, tell us about your adoptive family. How is it that you came to them?
Actually, I'm the fourth of four children, so I'm the youngest, and after my mom had her third, they always wanted to have four kids for whatever reason. And so, but the third birth for my mom was really tough health-wise. So they decided to adopt. They started the process early 1967 to adopt me.
Now, transracial adoptions were very much not common at that time. And your parents lived in Dearborn in 1967. Tell us about the repercussions for a Lutheran minister living in Dearborn with a biracial child, and how it was that they came to search out and find a biracial child.
So they had approached the adoption agency, you know, and said, we want to adopt our, you know, our fourth child. And because they were technically still able to have children, they only qualified for, at that time, what was considered special needs or hard to place kids. And back in 1967, and actually in some places today, biracial children are considered hard to place. And so that's how I came to them, and then was taken home when I was 3 months old to their house in Dearborn. My dad was an associate pastor at a large Lutheran church in Dearborn, and much to our dismay, the church was very vocal about disproving of having this biracial child in their congregation. And so it actually, they tried to fire my father because he brought me into the church.
A very, just a very sad reaction, I'm sure. And it had to have been heart-wrenching for him to have been trying to follow his heart on the one side and then not being received with what one would hope might be Christian love and acceptance in his job.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what, you know, that's what really called him to bring, you know, me into his home was, you know, to open up his home to someone who needed a home, which is very, you know, along the lines of Christianity. So for other Christians to really very vocally, you know, stand up against that, yeah, it was very disheartening. And, yeah, and I don't get it to this day. I don't understand what they were thinking, but they felt very strong in their beliefs. And I think what one belief was that, you know, which is a common belief, is that with me was going to come all these other kids. And with what was going on in Detroit at that time, they were very fearful that, you know, Detroit was going to bleed over into their congregation.
So because of that, your father then moved the family to the northwest side of Detroit, to a neighborhood that was predominantly black. How was that for you? How old were you when that happened?
When we moved, I was 3 years old. So between age 3 and 8, we moved to a black neighborhood in the northwest side of Detroit. And the decision was made for my benefit so that I would grow up around kids that looked like me. And it was life-changing. I mean, I speak to a lot of, you know, adult adoptees now that grew up similar to me. And the biggest difference is they have grown up in white neighborhoods, white communities, white churches, white schools, and never had that connection with someone that looked like them. So when we moved to that black neighborhood, I mean, those, I talk about it all the time, those kids who were my peers became like superheroes to me and gave me such a great view of what black was. And it made me want to be part of that group instead of really struggling with who I was as far as a person of color.
And how was it for your white brothers and sister?
Yeah, and that's kind of the sacrifice that was made, because it was tough for my, you know, I have two brothers and a sister. And my sister's 5 years older than me, so she didn't come out and play as much. And so she wasn't affected by it as much as my brothers and the fact that she was female. But my brothers, yeah, were harassed because they were the different ones in the community. And so, yeah, they were harassed, chased home. I remember, you know, I have a brother that's a year older than me that was, you know, several times I remember him being chased home by neighborhood kids, you know, threatening to hurt him. And it was, you know, simply because he was the different one.
And then now, years later, looking back, how do your brothers and sister feel about the black community, since that did present challenges for them at a really formative time?
Yeah, my sister actually is, and this has a lot to do with personality, but my sister just really was good with it. And it's interesting because then, I mean, she grew up and she got married and she married a black man. And they had a child and then they got divorced and then she just recently married another black man. So, I mean, it did change her view of the world. My brothers, it changed their view, but they grew up very, in my opinion, very resentful because of that. And I think the way they see it is, you know, the whole family made these huge sacrifices for one.
Has that affected your relationship with them even today, just on as brother to brother?
Yeah, it's a pretty strange relationship. I mean, especially, you know, when the book came out, you know, I had sent it to the whole family and said, it's about to be published, you know, look it over and let me know what you think. And, you know, one brother didn't respond. My other brother responded through my mom and my sister, but never came to me and said anything about it. And his answer or his response was, well, you know, that's not how I remember things. Hmm. And so, yeah, I think it was tough for him to grow up like that, being the minority. But honestly, you know, I went to my friends before I wrote the book and I said, so what'd you think of my brother? You know, this white kid in this all black environment. And they thought he did well. He adjusted well to the environment and seemed very comfortable around, you know, people of color, which isn't always the case.
It's interesting how the perception on the outside differs from what he was feeling inside his head. And so you've really seen within your own family the way that racial strains can present themselves and become part of the way you look at the world.
Yeah, I've told my mom and dad this. I think one area where we fell short on, although, man, they did so much. They made so many strides. But what we could have done a better job with was just talking about stuff. A lot of that had to do with the times. I mean, that was pre-Oprah and pre-Dr. Phil. And so families weren't really around about talking about their feelings. But, yeah, we should have done a better job of including them where in some of the decisions that were made in the family. And I don't think they feel they were.
Mm. Talking with author Kevin Hoffman, his memoir, Growing Up Black in White. Kevin was born in Detroit just 2.5 weeks after the Detroit riots, born to a white mother and a black father, placed in foster care, and then he was adopted by a white family where he became the fourth of their children. Kevin, through your high school years and into your college years, what shade of black did you choose to show, especially in college, because you wound up at a small private college? You said it was the whitest place you've ever seen.
Well, through high school, I went to, you know, a local Benedict King High School, which then was, you know, predominant, largely black, like 95-98% black.
Mm-hmm.
And so, man, was that a great time for me, because it allowed me, you know, to really feel comfortable around people that look like me. And I've done a lot of research on racial identity and what I was going through at the time, and have found comfort in the fact that, man, what I was going through is typically what a lot of black, especially males, go through. And so we did a lot of acting out in high school where, I mean, we became your stereotypical, you know, black males. I mean, we were very loud and obnoxious and just very in your face. And what I found is, that's very, you know, it's there's actually a term for it. It's called oppositional identity. Where,
and why is that? What drives the need to be that way?
I think it's an interesting combination, because as you're a black male growing up, you're trying to figure out what that exactly means. And you're so influenced by society and society's view of black that you become what society tells you black is. So we became the stereotypical black kids, because that's what was being fed to us through media and everything that we were a part of. I became that. And then it's a defense mechanism. It keeps people at bay, and it keeps people at a distance when you can be that vocal and that loud and really that in your face. And so, yeah, I carried that over into this. You know, I went to Elma College up in Elma, Michigan, which was a small college of 1,100 students, and only 13 of us were black. I took that kind of, you know, persona up into this all-white environment and became, you know, I often joke and say, you know, I became the blackest black man I could be. And it probably wasn't the best choice, but, I mean, it was, again, a way to protect myself from being hurt. And, yeah, there were some hurtful situations that went on in college, because I was, you know, a minority.
I'm really curious, what drove you to Alma College when there were so many other options from Wayne State University, or, you know, places where there would be a greater mix of ethnicities?
And here's the interesting thing is that, so I grew up in Detroit surrounded by kids that look like me. I'm real comfortable in that situation. And I assume, and again, we should have had these conversations in the home, but I grew up assuming the world was like Detroit.
And you found out.
And my dad even says now, he says, you know, what were you thinking, you know, about going to Alma College from Detroit? And, man, was it culture shock. I mean, so then I found out what the world is really like and how they view people of color. And, yeah, it was a tough 4 years.
As you move out of college and into your adult life and you marry and you become a parent, as you look back through your life, Kevin Hoffman, do you feel as accepted in the white world as in the black world?
Oh, no. And you know, I do a lot of speaking to predominantly, you know, white parents that have adopted children of color. And I often get the question, because I'm biracial, is how come you identify as black and not white? And my smart answer is, well, I never knew I had a choice. I mean, I present as a black male. I've always been seen and treated and translated as a black male. So, I mean, that's what I identify with. And some people, man, they take exception to that. And I learned early on, you know, so we lived in that black neighborhood for 5 years. And then my dad got a promotion and we moved to Rosedale Park, which was an upper middle class white neighborhood in Detroit. And, man, was that culture shock, too, because now I'm playing with white kids, you know, after school and on the weekends. And they let me know right away there was no way I was going to just kind of pass as white, that I wasn't just going to fit in.
Kevin Hoffman, as you have watched Barack Obama rise from being an Illinois senator to president, and as we talk today, he's going through his second inauguration. So we are now living in a country in which a majority of voters have said yes to a black president, not once, but twice. And you were present in Washington as he was sworn into office in 2009. Why was it so important to you to be, at least in the city? I know you couldn't, through a number of circumstances, couldn't actually make it to the mall, but you said it was a profound experience for you. Why was it?
The first thing was because I never thought it would happen. I just thought maybe my kids would see that when they were about my age, but I just never thought I would see a black man in office. And so, especially, you know, growing up the way I did, man, to be able to see, you know, a black man in, you know, the highest office, you know, in our country, it was just, it was a profound experience for me. I think part of me was hoping there was some acceptance there that, you know, finally, you know, maybe we could get past some of this stuff that's really bogged our country down, you know, the racism that's bogged us down. But I don't think we have. I mean, a lot of people like to say we're post-racial now. I don't think that's true. I think my kids deal more with racial issues than I did growing up.
What do you see in Barack Obama that resounds in your core, that resounds with your background? What part of being a biracial child do you think informs the way that he views the world and the way he approaches his presidency?
I think, you know, being biracial, you have this unique experience to kind of be able to talk to both sides. And also, I think, honestly, I hate to say this, but I think white people are more comfortable with a biracial president because there is that white part of him. And so, yeah, I think that plays better for a large part of our population. What really, you know, strikes a chord with me about Barack Obama is just that the class and what he represents, not really to me, but to my kids. I mean, I remember, yeah, we went to the inauguration and we toured Washington, D.C. the day after. And we went to the White House the day after he was sworn in. And I remember standing outside the gates and thinking, wow, you know, the first family is actually in the house, in the White House now. And then it occurred to me, you know, this is a possibility that my kids could actually be president of the United States. They could grow up with a goal that, to me, was never a reality. And that really hit home for me.
So what are your hopes and fears for the America that your kids will be living in as adults?
That we can sit down and have the conversation. I tried working with the school system with several issues that my boys were going through. And I was on a token council, but it was the diversity council. And, you know, I was talking to a woman who was actually running the council, and, you know, she made the statement, well, can't we have this conversation and not talk about the past? And I really thought about that, and I said, no, you can't. You can't. Unfortunately, you can't. And this was a white woman, so what she wanted to do was just forget about all the ugly stuff that happened in the past and just move forward. And to really have a constructive conversation about race, you got to go through the ugly stuff, and you got to allow people to voice their pain and their bitterness and their anger from what they went through. And I'm hoping that we can get to that point. Unfortunately, man, I've seen so much ugliness because we have a person of color in the White House that, I don't know. I don't know if we're better off today than when we were when I was growing up.
Kevin, interesting thoughts, and we thank you for talking with us today. Kevin D. Hoffman's memoir, Growing Up Black in White, and he joined us today from his home in Toledo. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Mark Brush. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Maya Friedman, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk tomorrow at 3:00.